Third District Court is now in session. The Honorable Judge Judith Atherton presiding. You can be seated.
Some, right? I thought they had it. We'll see you later.
It's going to be after a lot.
I said we could do it in a minute. Yeah.
Let's take the matter of the
City of
Utah versus Eastar Magic number 08196270, Council State, their appearances.
Our Mike Peterson, John West, and his supporter present with Mr. Met. We also have our Burmese interpreter at Council Table.
Judge Ron Parrish and Matt Jansen for the state, with Troy McComb, who is our new case manager, one of the two case managers that we'll have during the trial.
And as such, he'll be at Council Table?
Yes.
Okay.
The time set for motion hearings, Mr. Peterson? Well, Your Honor, I would ask for the court to allow the counsel to briefly approach.
Okay. Matters concerning your motion. Motion to suppress the police interview. And what is your request then relative to that motion? And I'll ask make sure that the state is on board with that.
Now, my request in that regard is that we schedule a very short evidentiary hearing where the court will take very, very brief evidence, whether it be through direct sworn testimony or through proffer of the parties. I guess that can be determined at that time. I don't anticipate, Judge, more than a matter of perhaps 10 minutes of proffer and or testimony being adduced at that hearing. But I think it is important that the court listen carefully to what Mr. Met's position is with regard to the totality of the circumstances of that police interview, and then listen also carefully to the state's response with regard to what occurred during that police interview. And just so I'm crystal clear about the record that I have made in the previous pleading that I filed with regard to the suppression of Mr. Met's police interview, the allegation has not been that the police officers conducting the interview acted contrary to constitutional requirements and or acted coercively. The concern, as voiced in my memorandum and as somewhat echoed in the state's memorandum itself, where the state concedes that, for example, the interpretation relative to Miranda was insufficient, and the state has no opportunity of using the interview in their case in chief. Right, that's stipulated. What's highlighted, though, in that regard, Judge, in both my briefing and the state's response, is that the inadequacy in the interpretation is the fly in the ointment here. And that's where, specifically, Your Honor, the element of the coercion occurred, according to the defense's position.
And that's really something where you were very much looking at totality of the circumstances, even totality beyond the record.
Yeah, the answer to that is yes and no. And I hate to equivocate into a gray area. In other words, the interview itself was recorded, and there is a transcript, there is an audio, there is a video. We have that in its entirety. I've reviewed that with my client. Mr. Parrish and his staff have reviewed it, and now we're asking the court to likewise give that particular transcript and that recorded interview your consideration and analysis, along with your very capable capital clerk. But what I'm saying is, once that review has occurred, I need the court to hear briefly, either by way of proper or direct testimony from the defense, and then a response from the state. And I anticipate that response will come through the interpreter, who specifically was involved in this interview, because that's going to be the critical evidentiary basis for the court to analyze whether or not coercion did occur in this particular interview. So, having said that, Judge, I don't know that I need to elaborate much more on the merits of the coercive analysis as laid out in my memorandum and as addressed in the state's reply. I would ask that the court allow me to reserve the body of that argument for a time when the court has the full totality of the circumstances before
it. Time is of the essence. And thus far, as you also noted, the transcript as well as the DVD of this interview were dropped by the court. They have not been filed with court yet. From what I'm understanding from our discussion a moment ago, you did not object to my review of that transcript and my review of the DVD.
That's correct, Judge. In fact, we're encouraging the court to do just that, so that you are fully apprised of the totality of the circumstances, and then once you have this one additional layer that we will present, you will have everything that you need to make your assessment and ruling. And again, I can schedule this as quickly as the court would like and as quickly as this particular interpreter who is involved in the interview can be present. Perhaps the state will even want one or more of the officers that conducted that interview to be present. I appreciate from their plea that they don't think an evidentiary hearing is needed at all, because the recording itself, in their estimation, captures everything that was communicated. The defense's position is that's not quite the case, that there was an additional communication outside the confines of what the court has, that the court needs to know about.
Well, Judge, I'm a little bit concerned at this point because for a couple of reasons. One is, without the proffer, we really don't know what it is we're responding to in an evidentiary hearing. What I would request is that counsel share with us what that property would be so that we can prepare for this evidentiary hearing. It's a whole different area of the law when a translator chosen by the police is allegedly the person who coerced or used some kind of inappropriate tactics. I'm not aware of any case law that I was able to find, and I did look for that, where translators mistranslated, and that then became part of the issue. But the case law is very clear, Judge, that there has to be some element of coercive police activity in order to make a finding that an individual defendant's statement can't be used against him should he choose to testify. In other words, the finding of the defense is...
And that there's a causation factor as well.
And the causation factor is part two of that test. I'm not aware of any case anywhere that says that the interpreter has some kind of exchange with the suspect outside the confines of what's been recorded, that can meet that standard.
I think it's within the confines of what's been recorded, though. Right, Mr. Peter?
Well, that's part of what needs to be assessed and determined, Judge, at the hearing that will be conducted. And I can attempt to elucidate a little further where I'm heading with regard to the specific coercion at hand so that the state has sort of more adequate footing to prepare for that hearing. But what I'm trying to assure the court and state is I think it's just a question of bringing in that particular interpreter.
And I'm not sure that we even know where that person is.
I'm pretty sure we do.
Well, if they have information, that would be helpful. The second part, though, is we do have one of those two officers who's an FBI agent. We have to go through the full procedure to get an FBI agent here to testify, including having the assistant U.S. attorney here.
I don't know that there's a need for anybody to testify. I think we're talking about this third party, whether or not it's relevant. Can you be here? I don't know.
And I don't either because I don't know what it is yet.
But if you're talking about something that's outside of the context of the actual interview, I'm not sure it's relevant. I'm certainly willing to let you present your argument. But I'm not sure it's relevant. I'm not sure it's relevant.
It just puts us in a very difficult situation to know whom to subpoena and for what reason.
So, I'll leave it to you two. How's that? Next Wednesday?
I'm available.
Joe Lineup.
If you guys are busy, I can handle this. It's going to be very brief.
We can make that work, Your Honor.
All right.
December 11th and 11th.
Okay. So just relative to the brief hearing, put on the 2 o'clock calendar, the 11th of December, likely not be in this courtroom, which is most afternoons, but we will find somewhere in the courthouse. You can find from Melanie or
Shante.
Where it is. For me, but I may not know. Okay, so we finished the agreement then. I want to make sure that it's clear that the agreement of all parties is that I review this transcript as well as
the DVD. And that is both parties' position, and at this point, neither party has asked that, that either of those be made part of the record.
Right, and we've spoken relative to the confines of Rule 4202.404, if you wish to have those declared as classified and sealed. Okay, so today then we have.
Before we leave that particular analysis and the merits of where we're headed, I just want to make a brief record for the state's purposes. Mr. Met was under the impression that he needed to make some statement about what happened in that apartment with regard to this alleged victim, or he faced the immediate prospect of death. That's the general gist of what I can proffer at this point. It will be much more specific at the time we conduct the hearing.
Okay.
The question becomes, what is it that Mr. Met believes he was hearing, and what was it that this particular interpreter was conveying? And again, we all have what's been recorded during the interview. I know what the police did and did not say, did and did not do, as you will when you review it. The question becomes, when law enforcement is undertaking a very sensitive interview of their prime suspect in a potential capital murder case, and they bring in effectively an agent to act as their interpreter to make sure they're communicating clearly with the person that is going to prospectively face a death sentence, I'm heightening it in that regard, but it would apply to any in-custody police interrogation judge. But particularly in this context, the question has to become, what obligations does law enforcement have to make sure they know things are being communicated? Do they get to just grab some random Burmese refugee off the streets when they're investigating a case involving a potential Burmese defendant and hope for the best? Is that the standard? And if that Burmese interpreter begins to convey certain things that are outside the confines of what the law enforcement officials are asking, do they get to just say, oh, well, we didn't know? I mean, the analysis, Judge, is, was the interview coercive from Mr. Met's perspective?
Did he? Or is that? And that's something that you'll need to educate me on, relative to whether this standard for reviewing this is subjective,
right,
which you're requesting, or objective. Typically, when we look at right. Fourth Amendment type issues or suppression issues, this is the fourth, it's fifth. But it's objective, and it's
totality
of the circumstances. And that's my starting point. So
I appreciate that. And to some degree, Judge, I concede Mr. Parrish's point. We are broaching an issue of first impression. Certainly in Utah, and I've looked, as Mr. Parrish has nationwide, and I will look further for an additional support and analysis. I'm sure your capable capital clerk will as well. But the point is, at the end of the day, the analysis is, did the statements that came from the defendant come as a result of coercion that defendant was feeling? He doesn't speak English. He doesn't know if the interpreter is off the reservation, has gone rogue, or if the interpreter isn't repeating everything that law enforcement is asking to be repeated. His assumption is, the interpreter is saying to him what the officers want the interpreter to say to him, so that when the defendant in that seat, in those shoes, hears, you're going to die, he doesn't think the interpreter is making that up. He thinks law enforcement is saying that. That's the analysis.
We'll see. Also, whether the record supports what you've just
talked about.